for a curtain wall. All of these items are related to future costs and losses. It is easy to say that they're not part of the regular operating results of 1970, but if so, where do they belong? Are they so extraordinary and non-recurring as to belong nowhere? A widespread enterprise such as Alcoa, doing a $1.5 billion business annually, must have a lot of divisions, departments, affiliates, and the like. Would it not be normal, rather than extraordinary, for one or more to prove unprofitable and to require closing down? Similarly for such things as a contract to build a wall. Suppose that at any time a company had a loss on any part of its business, it had the bright idea of charging it off as a special item, and thus reporting its primary earnings per share so as to include only its profitable contracts and operations. Like King Edward VII's sundial that marked only the sunny hours. The listener should note two ingenious aspects of the Alcoa procedure we've been discussing. The first is that by anticipating future losses, the company escapes the necessity of allocating the losses themselves to an identifiable year. They don't belong in 1970 because they were not actually taken in that year. And they won't be shown in the year when they are actually taken because they've already been provided for. Neat work. But might it not be just a little misleading? The Alcoa footnote says nothing about the future tax saving from these losses. Most other statements of this sort state specifically that only the after-tax effect has been charged off. If the Alcoa figure represents future losses before the related tax credit, then not only will future earnings be freed from the weight of these charges, as they are actually incurred, but they will be increased by a tax credit of some 50% thereof. It is difficult to believe that the accounts will be handled that way, but it is a fact that certain companies which have had large losses in the past have been able to report future earnings without charging the normal taxes against them, in that way making a very fine profits appearance indeed, based, paradoxically enough, on their past disgraces. Tax credits resulting from past years' losses are now being shown separately as special items, but they will enter into future statistics as part of the final net income figure. However, a reserve now set up for future losses if net of expected tax credit should not create an addition of this sort to the net income of later years. The other ingenious feature is the use by Alcoa and many other companies of the 1970 year-end for making these special charge-offs. The stock market took what appeared to be a bloodbath in the first half of 1970. Everyone expected relatively poor results for the year for most companies. Wall Street was now anticipating better results in 1971, 1972, etc. What a nice arrangement, then, to charge as much as possible to the bad year, which had already been written off mentally and had virtually receded into the past, leaving the way clear for nicely fattened figures in the next few years. Perhaps this is good accounting, good business policy, and good for management-shareholder relationships. But we have lingering doubts. The combination of widely, or should it be wildly, diversified operations, with the impulse to clean house at the end of 1970, has produced some strange-looking footnotes to the annual reports. The listener may be amused by the following explanation given by a New York Stock Exchange company, which shall remain unnamed, of its special items aggregating $2,357,000, or about a third of the income before charge-offs. Consists of provision for closing Spalding United Kingdom operations. Provision for reorganizational expenses of a division. Costs of selling a small baby pants and bib manufacturing company. Disposing of part interest in a Spanish car leasing facility. And liquidation of a ski boot operation. Years ago, the strong companies used to set up contingency reserves out of the profits of good years to absorb some of the bad effects of depression years to come. The underlying idea was to equalize the reported earnings, more or less, and to improve the stability factor in the company's record. A worthy motive, it would seem. But the accountants quite rightly objected to the practice as misstating the true earnings. They insisted that each year's results be presented as they were, good or bad, and the shareholders and analysts be allowed to do the averaging or equalizing for themselves. We seem now to be witnessing the opposite phenomenon, with everyone charging off as much as possible against forgotten 1970, so as to start 1971 with a slate not only clean, but specially prepared to show pleasing per-share figures in the coming years. Is it time to return to our first question? What then were the true earnings of Alcoa in 1970? The accurate answer would be the $5.01 per share after dilution, less that part of the 82 cents of special charges that may properly be attributed to occurrences in 1970. But we do not know what that portion is, and hence we cannot properly state the true earnings for the year. The management and the auditors should have given us their best judgment on this point, but they did not do so. Provided for deduction of the balance of these charges from the ordinary earnings of a suitable number of future years, say not more than five. This evidently they will not do either, since they have already conveniently disposed of the entire sum as a 1970 special charge. The more seriously investors take the per-share earnings figures as published, the more necessary it is for them to be on their guard against accounting factors of one kind and another that may impair the true comparability of the numbers. We have mentioned three sorts of these factors: the use of special charges, which may never be reflected in the per-share earnings, the reduction in the normal income tax deduction by reason of past losses, and the dilution factor implicit in the existence of substantial amounts of convertible securities or warrants. A fourth item that has had a significant effect on reported earnings in the past is the method of treating depreciation, chiefly as between the straight line and the accelerated schedules. We refrain from details here, but as an example, current as we write, let us mention the 1970 report of Train Company. This firm showed an increase of nearly 20% in per-share earnings over 1969, $3.29 versus $2.76. But half of this came from returning to the older straight-line depreciation rates, less burdensome on earnings than the accelerated method used the year before. The company will continue to use the accelerated rate on its income tax return, thus deferring income tax payments on the difference. Still another factor, important at times, is the choice between charging off research and development costs in the year they are incurred or amortizing them over a period of years. Finally, let us mention the choice between the FIFO, first in, first out, and LIFO, last in, first out, methods of valuing inventories. An obvious remark here would be that investors should not pay any attention to these accounting variables if the amounts involved are relatively small. But Wall Street, being as it is, even items quite minor in themselves can be taken seriously. 2 days before the Alcoa report appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the paper had quite a discussion of the corresponding statement of Dow Chemical. It closed with the observation that many analysts had been troubled by the fact that Dow had included a 21-cent item in regular profits for 1969, instead of treating it as an item of extraordinary income. Why the fuss? Because, evidently, evaluations of Dow Chemical involving many millions of dollars in the aggregate seemed to depend on exactly what was the percentage gain for 1969 over 1968, in this case either 9% or 4.5%. This strikes us as rather absurd. It is very unlikely that small differences involved in one year's results could have any bearing on future average profits or growth, and on a conservative, realistic valuation of the enterprise. By contrast, consider another statement also appearing in January 1971. This concerned Northwest Industries Incorporated's report for 1970. The company was planning to write off as a special charge not less than $264 million in one fell swoop. Of this, $200 million represents the loss to be taken on the proposed sale of the railroad subsidiary to its employees, and the balance a write-down of a recent stock purchase. These sums would work out to a loss of about $35 per share of common before dilution offsets, or twice its then current market price. Here we have something really significant. If the transaction goes through, and if the tax laws are not changed, this loss provided for in 1970 will permit Northwest Industries to realize about $400 million of future profits within 5 years from its other diversified interests, without paying income tax thereon. What will then be the real earnings of that enterprise? Should they be calculated with or without provision for the nearly 50% in income taxes which it will not actually have to pay? In our opinion, the proper mode of calculation would be first to consider the indicated earning power on the basis of full income tax liability, and to derive some broad idea of the stock's value based on that estimate. To this should be added some bonus figure, representing the value per share of the important but temporary tax exemption the company will enjoy. Allowances must be made also for a possible large-scale dilution in this case. Actually, the convertible preferred issues and warrants would more than double the outstanding common shares if the privileges are exercised. All this may be confusing and wearisome to our listeners, but it belongs in our story. Corporate accounting is often tricky. Security analysis can be complicated. Stock valuations are really dependable only in exceptional cases. For most investors, it would be probably best to assure themselves that they are getting good value for the prices they pay, and let it go at that. Use of average earnings. In former times, analysts and investors paid considerable attention to the average earnings over a fairly long period in the past, usually from 7 to 10 years. This mean figure was useful for ironing out the frequent ups and downs of the business cycle, and it was thought to give a better idea of the company's earning power than the results of the latest year alone. One important advantage of such an averaging process is that it will solve the problem of what to do about nearly all the special charges and credits. They should be included in the average earnings. For certainly, most of these losses and gains represent a part of the company's operating history. If we do this for Alcoa, the average earnings for 1961 through 1970, 10 years, would appear as $3.62, and for the 7 years 1964 through 1970 as $4.62 per share. If such figures are used in conjunction with ratings for growth and stability of earnings during the same period, they could give a really informing picture of the company's past performance. Calculation of the past growth rate. It is of prime importance that the growth factor in a company's record be taken adequately into account. Where the growth has been large, the recent earnings will be well above the 7 or 10 year average, and analysts may deem these long-term figures irrelevant. This need not be the case. The earnings can be given in terms both of the average and the latest figure. We suggest that the growth rate itself be calculated by comparing the average of the last 3 years with corresponding figures 10 years earlier. Where there is a problem of special charges or credits, it may be dealt with on some compromise basis. Note the following calculation for the growth of Alcoa as against that of Sears Roebuck and the DJIA group as a whole. Comment. These few figures could be made the subject of a long discussion. They probably show as well as any others derived by elaborate mathematical treatment the actual growth of earnings for the long period 1958 through 1970. But how relevant is this figure, generally considered central in common stock valuations, to the case of Alcoa? Its past growth rate was excellent, actually a bit better than that of acclaimed Sears Roebuck, and much higher than that of the DJIA composite. But the market price at the beginning of 1971 seemed to pay no attention to this fine performance. Alcoa sold at only 11.5 times the recent 3-year average. while Sears sold at 27 times, and the DJIA itself at 15-plus times. How did this come about? Evidently, Wall Street has fairly pessimistic views about the future course of Alcoa's earnings, in contrast with its past record. Surprisingly enough, the high price for Alcoa was made as far back as 1959. In that year, it sold at 116, or 45 times its earnings. This compares with a 1959 adjusted high price of 25.5 for Sears Roebuck, or 20 times its then earnings. Even though Alcoa's profits did show excellent growth thereafter, it is evident that in this case, the future possibilities were greatly overestimated in the market price. It closed 1970 at exactly half of the 1959 high, while Sears tripled in price and the DJIA moved up nearly 30%. It should be pointed out that Alcoa's earnings on capital funds had been only average or less, and this may be the decisive factor here. High multipliers have been maintained in the stock market only if the company has maintained better than average profitability. Let us apply at this point to Alcoa the suggestion we made in the previous chapter for a two-part appraisal process. Such an approach might have produced a past performance value for Alcoa of 10% of the DJIA, or $84 per share relative to the closing price of $840 for the DJIA in 1970. On this basis, the shares would have appeared quite attractive at their price of 57¼. To what extent should the senior analyst have marked down the past performance value to allow for adverse developments that he saw in the future? Frankly, we have no idea. Assume he had reason to believe that the 1971 earnings would be as low as $2.50 per share. A large drop from the 1970 figure, as against an advance expected for the DJIA. Very likely the stock market would take this poor performance quite seriously, but would it really establish the once mighty Aluminum Company of America as a relatively unprofitable enterprise, to be valued at less than its tangible assets behind the shares? In 1971, the price declined from a high of 70 in May to a low of 36 in December, against a book value of 55. Alcoa is surely a representative industrial company of huge size, but we think that its price and earnings history is more unusual, even contradictory, than that of most other large enterprises. Yet this instance supports to some degree the doubts we expressed in the last chapter as to the dependability of the appraisal procedure when applied to the typical industrial company. Commentary on Chapter 12. You can get ripped off easier by a dude with a pen than you can by a dude with a gun. Bo Diddley. The numbers game. Even Graham would have been startled by the extent to which companies and their accountants pushed the limits of propriety in the past few years. Compensated heavily through stock options, top executives realized that they could become fabulously rich merely by increasing their company's earnings for just a few years running. Hundreds of companies violated the spirit, if not the letter, of accounting principles, turning their financial reports into gibberish, tarting up ugly results with cosmetic fixes, cloaking expenses, or manufacturing earnings out of thin air. Let's look at some of these unsavory practices. As if. Perhaps the most widespread bit of accounting hocus-pocus was the pro forma earnings fad. There's an old saying on Wall Street that every bad idea starts out as a good idea, and pro forma earnings presentation is no different. The original point was to provide a truer picture of the long-term growth of earnings by adjusting for short-term deviations from the trend, or for supposedly non-recurring events. A pro forma press release might, for instance, show what a company would have earned over the past year if another firm it just acquired had been part of the family for the entire 12 months. But as the naughty 90s advanced, companies just couldn't leave well enough alone. Just look at these examples of pro forma flimflam. For the quarter ended September 30, 1999, Infospace Incorporated presented its pro forma earnings as if it had not paid $159 million in preferred stock dividends. For the quarter ended October 31, 2001, BEA Systems Incorporated presented its pro forma earnings as if it had not paid $193 million in payroll taxes on stock options exercised by its employees. For the quarter ended March 31, 2001, JDS Uniphase Corporation presented its pro forma earnings as if it had not paid $4 million in payroll taxes, had not lost $7 million investing in lousy stocks, and had not incurred $2.5 billion in charges related to mergers and goodwill. In short, pro forma earnings enable companies to show how well they might have done if they hadn't done as badly as they did. As an intelligent investor, the only thing you should do with pro forma earnings is ignore them. Hungry for recognition. In 2000, QS Communications International Incorporated, the telecommunications giant, looked strong. Its shares dropped less than 5%, even as the stock market lost more than 9% that year. But QWEST's financial reports held an odd little revelation. In late 1999, QWEST decided to recognize the revenues from its telephone directories as soon as the phone books were published, even though, as anyone who's ever taken out a Yellow Page advertisement knows, many businesses pay for those ads in monthly installments. Abracadabra. That piddly-sounding change in accounting principle pumped up 1999 net income by $240 million after taxes, a fifth of all the money QWEST earned that year. Like a little chunk of ice crowning a submerged iceberg, aggressive revenue recognition is often a sign of dangers that run deep and loom large. And so it was at QWEST. By early 2003, after reviewing its previous financial statements, the company announced that it had prematurely recognized profits on equipment sales, improperly recorded the costs of services provided by outsiders, inappropriately booked costs as if they were capital assets rather than expenses, and unjustifiably treated the exchange of assets as if they were outright sales. All told, QWEST's revenues for 2000 and 2001 had been overstated by $2.2 billion, including $80 million from the earlier change in accounting principle, which was now reversed. Capital offenses. In the late 1990s, Global Crossing Limited had unlimited ambitions. The Bermuda-based company was building what it called the first integrated global fiber optic network, over more than 100,000 miles of cables, largely laid across the floor of the world's oceans. After wiring the world, Global Crossing would sell other communications companies the right to carry their traffic over its network of cables. In 1998 alone, Global Crossing spent more than $600 million to construct its optical web. That year, nearly a third of the construction budget was charged against revenues as an expense called cost of capacity sold. If not for that $178 million expense, Global Crossing, which reported a net loss of $96 million, could have reported a net profit of roughly $82 million. The next year, says a bland footnote in the 1999 annual report, Global Crossing initiated service contract accounting. The company would no longer charge most construction costs as expenses against the immediate revenues it received from selling capacity on its network. Instead, a major chunk of those construction costs would now be treated not as an operating expense, but as a capital expenditure, thereby increasing the company's total assets instead of decreasing its net income. Poof! In one wave of the wand, Global Crossing's property and equipment assets rose by $575 million, while its cost of sales increased by a mere $350 million, even though the company was spending money like a drunken sailor. Capital expenditures are an essential tool for managers to make a good business grow bigger and better. But malleable accounting rules permit managers to inflate reported profits by transforming normal operating expenses into capital assets. As the Global Crossing case shows, the intelligent investor should be sure to understand what and why a company capitalizes. An inventory story. Like many makers of semiconductor chips, Micron Technology Incorporated suffered a drop in sales after 2000. In fact, Micron was hit so hard by the plunge in demand that it had to start writing down the value of its inventories, since customers clearly did not want them at the prices Micron had been asking. In the quarter ended May 2001, Micron slashed the recorded value of its inventories by $261 million. Most investors interpreted the write-down not as a normal or recurring cost of operations, but as an unusual event. But look what happened after that, by taking a look at Figure 12.1 on the enhancement. Micron booked further inventory write-downs in every one of the next six fiscal quarters. Was the devaluation of Micron's inventory a non-recurring event, or had it become a chronic condition? Reasonable minds can differ on this particular case, but one thing is clear. The intelligent investor must always be on guard for non-recurring costs that, like the Energizer Bunny, just keep on going. The Pension Dimension. In 2001, SBC Communications Incorporated, which owns interests in Singular Wireless, Pactel, and Southern New England Telephone, earned $7.2 billion in net income, a stellar performance in a bad year for the overextended telecom industry. But that gain didn't come only from SBC's business. Fully $1.4 billion of it, 13% of the company's net income, had come from SBC's pension plan. Because SBC had more money in the pension plan than it estimated was necessary to pay its employees' future benefits, the company got to treat the difference as current income. One simple reason for that surplus: in 2001, SBC raised the rate of return it expected to earn on the pension plan's investments from 8.5% to 9%, lowering the amount of money it needed to set aside today. SBC explained its rosy new expectations by noting that for each of the 3 years ended 2001, our actual 10-year return on investments exceeded 10%. In other words, our past returns have been high, so let's assume that our future returns will be too. But that not only flunked the most rudimentary tests of logic, it flew in the face of the fact that interest rates were falling to near-record lows, depressing the future returns on the bond portion of a pension portfolio. The same year, in fact, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway lowered the expected rate of return on its pension assets from 8.3% to 6.5%. Was SBC being realistic in assuming that its pension fund managers could significantly outperform the world's greatest investor? Probably not. In 2001, Berkshire Hathaway's pension fund gained 9.8%, but SBC's pension fund lost 6.9%. Here's some quick considerations for the intelligent investor. Is the net pension benefit more than 5% of the company's net income? If so, would you still be comfortable with the company's other earnings if those pension gains went away in future years? Is the assumed long-term rate of return on plan assets reasonable? As of 2003, anything above 6.5% is implausible, while a rising rate is downright delusional. Caveat investor. A few pointers will help you avoid buying a stock that turns out to be an accounting time bomb. Read backwards. When you research a company's financial reports, start reading on the last page and slowly work your way toward the front. Anything that the company doesn't want you to find is buried in the back, which is precisely why you should look there first. Read the notes. Never buy a stock without reading the footnotes to the financial statements in the annual report, usually labeled Summary of Significant Accounting Policies. One key note describes how the company recognizes revenue, records inventories, treats installment or contract sales, expenses its marketing costs, and accounts for the other major aspects of its business. In the other footnotes, watch for disclosures about debt, stock options, loans to customers, reserves against losses, and other risk factors that can take a big chomp out of earnings. Among the things that should make your antennae twitch are technical terms like capitalized, deferred, and restructuring, and plain English words signaling that the company has altered its accounting practices, like began, change, and however. None of those words mean you should not buy the stock, but all mean that you need to investigate further. Be sure to compare the footnotes with those in the financial statements of at least one firm that's a close competitor, to see how aggressive your company's accountants are. Read more. If you are an enterprising investor, willing to put plenty of time and energy into your portfolio, then you owe it to yourself to learn more about financial reporting. That's the only way to minimize your odds of being misled by a shifty earnings statement. Three solid books, full of timely and specific examples, are Martin Fridson and Fernando Alvarez's Financial Statement Analysis, Charles Mulford and Eugene Comiskey's The Financial Numbers Game, and Howard Schillett's Financial Shenanigans. Chapter 13. A comparison of four listed companies. In this chapter, we should like to present a sample of security analysis in operation. We have selected, more or less at random, four companies which are found successively on the New York Stock Exchange list. These are Eltra Corporation, a merger of Electric Autolite and Mergen Taylor Linotype Enterprises; Emerson Electric Company, a manufacturer of electric and electronic products; Emery Air Freight, a domestic forwarder of air freight; and Emhart Corporation, originally a maker of bottling machinery only, but now also in builder's hardware. There are some broad resemblances between the three manufacturing firms, but the differences will seem more significant. There should be sufficient variety in the financial and operating data to make the examination of interest. In Table 13.1, found on the enhancement, we present a summary of what the four companies were selling for in the market at the end of 1970, and a few figures on their 1970 operations. We then detail certain key ratios, which relate on the one hand to performance and on the other to price. Comment is called for on how various aspects of the performance pattern agree with the relative price pattern. Finally, we shall pass the four companies in review, suggesting some comparisons and relationships, and evaluating each in terms of the requirements of a conservative common stock investor. The most striking fact about the four companies is that the current price-to-earnings ratios vary much more widely than their operating performance or financial condition. Two of the enterprises, Eltra and Emhart, were modestly priced at only 9.7 times and 12 times the average earnings for 1968 through 1970, as against a similar figure of 15.5 times for the DJIA. The other two, Emerson and Emery, showed very high multiples of 33 and 45 times such earnings. There is bound to be some explanation of a difference such as this, and it is found in the superior growth of the favored company's profits in recent years, especially by the freight forwarder. But the growth figures of the two firms were not unsatisfactory. For more comprehensive treatment, let us review briefly the chief elements of performance as they appear from our figures. 1. Profitability. A. All the companies show satisfactory earnings on their book value, but the figures for Emerson and Emery are much higher than for the other two, A high rate of return on invested capital often goes along with a high annual growth rate in earnings per share. All the companies except Emory showed better earnings on book value in 1969 than in 1961. But the Emory figure was exceptionally large in both years. B. For manufacturing companies, the profit figure per dollar of sales is usually an indication of comparative strength or weakness. We use here the ratio of operating income to sales, as given in Standard & Poor's listed stock reports. Here again the results are satisfactory for all four companies, with an especially impressive showing by Emerson. The changes between 1961 and 1969 vary considerably among the companies. 2. Stability. This we measure by the maximum decline in per-share earnings in any one of the past 10 years, as against the average of the three preceding years. No decline translates into 100% stability, and this was registered by the two popular concerns. But the shrinkages of Eltra and Emhart were quite moderate in the poor year, 1970, amounting to only 8% each by our measurement, against 7% for the DJIA. 3. Growth. The two low-multiplier companies show quite satisfactory growth rates, in both cases doing better than the Dow Jones Group. The Eltra figures are especially impressive when set against its low price-to-earnings ratio. The growth is, of course, more impressive for the high-multiplier pair. 4. Financial position. The three manufacturing companies are in sound financial condition, having better than the standard ratio of $2 of current assets for $1 of current liabilities. Emory Air Freight has a lower ratio, but it falls in a different category, and with its fine record, it would have no problem raising needed cash. All the companies have relatively low long-term debt. Dilution note. Emerson Electric had $163 million of market value of low-dividend convertible preferred shares outstanding at the end of 1970. In our analysis, we've made allowance for the dilution factor in the usual way, by treating the preferred as if converted into common. This decreased recent earnings by about 10 cents per share, or some 4%. 5. Dividends. What really counts is the history of continuance without interruption. The best record here is Emhart's, which has not suspended a payment since 1902. Eltra's record is very good. Emerson's quite satisfactory. Emory Freight is a newcomer. The variations in payout percentage do not seem especially significant. Current dividend yield is twice as high on the cheap pair as on the dear pair, corresponding to the price-to-earnings ratios. 6. Price history. The listener should be impressed by the percentage advance shown in the price of all four of these issues, as measured from the lowest to the highest points during the past 34 years. In all cases, the low price has been adjusted for subsequent stock splits. Note that for the DJIA, the range from low to high was on the order of 11 to 1. For our companies, the spread has varied from only 17 to 1 for Emhart to no less than 528 to 1 for Emory Air Freight. These manifold price advances are characteristic of most of our older common stock issues, and they proclaim the great opportunities of profit that have existed in the stock markets of the past. But they may indicate also how overdone were the declines in the bear markets before 1950, when the low prices were registered. Both Eltra and Emhart sustained price shrinkages of more than 50% in the 1969 through 70 price break. Emerson and Emory had serious but less distressing declines. The former rebounded to a new all-time high before the end of 1970, the latter in early 1971. General observations on the four companies. Emerson Electric has an enormous total market value, dwarfing the other three companies combined. It is one of our goodwill giants, to be commented on later. A financial analyst, blessed or handicapped, with a good memory, will think of an analogy between Emerson Electric and Zenith Radio, and that would not be reassuring. For Zenith had a brilliant growth record for many years. It too sold in the market for $1.7 billion in 1966. but its profits fell from $43 million in 1968 to only half as much in 1970. And in that year's big sell-off, its price declined to 22.5 against the previous top of 89. High valuations entail high risks. Emery Air Freight must be the most promising of the four companies in terms of future growth. If the price-to-earnings ratio of nearly 40 times its highest reported earnings is to be even partially justified. The past growth, of course, has been most impressive, but these figures may not be so significant for the future if we consider that they started quite small, at only $570,000 of net earnings in 1958. It often proves much more difficult to continue to grow at a high rate after volume and profits have already expanded to big totals. The most surprising aspect of Emery's story is that its earnings and market price continued to grow apace in 1970, which was the worst year in the domestic air passenger industry. This is a remarkable achievement indeed, but it raises the question whether future profits may not be vulnerable to adverse developments through increased competition, pressure for new arrangements between forwarders and airlines, etc. An elaborate study might be needed before a sound judgment could be passed on these points. But the conservative investor cannot leave them out of his general reckoning. Emhart and Eltra. Emhart has done better in its business than in the stock market over the past 14 years. In 1958, it sold as high as 22 times the current earnings, about the same ratio as for the DJIA. Since then, its profits tripled, as against a rise of less than 100% for the Dow. But its closing price in 1970 was only a third above the 1958 high, versus 43% for the Dow. The record of Eltra is somewhat similar. It appears that neither of these companies possesses glamour or sex appeal in the present market. But in all the statistical data, they show up surprisingly well. Their future prospects? We have no sage remarks to make here. But this is what Standard & Poor's had to say about the four companies in 1971. Eltra. Long-term prospects. Certain operations are cyclical, but an established competitive position and diversification are offsetting factors. Emerson Electric. While adequately priced at 71 on the current outlook, the shares have appeal for the long term. A continued acquisition policy, together with a strong position in industrial fields and an accelerated international program, suggests further sales and earnings progress. Emery Air Freight. The shares appear amply priced at 57 on current prospects, but are well worth holding for the long pull. Emhart. Although restricted this year by lower capital spending in the glass container industry, earnings should be aided by an improved business environment in 1972. The shares are worth holding at 34. Conclusions. Many financial analysts will find Emerson and Emery more interesting and appealing stocks than the other two, primarily perhaps because of their better market action, and secondarily because of their faster recent growth in earnings. Under our principles of conservative investment, the first is not a valid reason for selection. That is something for the speculators to play around with. The second has validity, but within limits. Can the past growth and the presumably good prospects of Emery Air Freight justify a price more than 60 times its recent earnings? Our answer would be, maybe, for someone who's made an in-depth study of the possibilities of this company and come up with exceptionally firm and optimistic conclusions. But not for the careful investor who wants to be reasonably sure in advance that he is not committing the typical Wall Street error of overenthusiasm for good performance in earnings and in the stock market. The same cautionary statement seemed called for in the case of Emerson Electric, with a special reference to the market's current valuation of over $1 billion for the intangible or earning power factor here. We should add that the electronics industry, once a fair-haired child of the stock market, has in general fallen on disastrous days. Emerson is an outstanding exception, but it will have to continue to be such an exception for a great many years in the future before the 1970 closing price will have been fully justified by its subsequent performance. By contrast, both Eltra at 27 and Emhart at 33 have the earmarks of companies with sufficient value behind their price to constitute reasonably protected investments. Here the investor can, if he wishes, consider himself basically a part owner of these businesses, at a cost corresponding to what the balance sheet shows to be the money invested therein. The rate of earnings on invested capital has long been satisfactory. The stability of profits also. The past growth rate, surprisingly so. The two companies will meet our 7 statistical requirements for inclusion in a defensive investor's portfolio. These will be developed in the next chapter, but we summarize them as follows. 1. Adequate size. 2. A sufficiently strong financial condition. 3. Continued dividends for at least the past 20 years. 4. No earnings deficit in the past 10 years. 5. 10-year growth of at least one-third in per-share earnings. 6. Price of stock no more than 1.5 times net asset value. 7. Price no more than 15 times average earnings of the past 3 years. We make no predictions about the future earnings performance of Eltra or Emhart. In the investors' diversified list of common stocks, there are bound to be some that prove disappointing, and this may be the case for one or both of this pair. But the diversified list itself, based on the listed principles of selection, plus whatever other sensible criteria the investor may wish to apply, should perform well enough across the years. At least, long experience tells us so. A final observation. An experienced security analyst, even if he accepted our general reasoning on these 4 companies, would have hesitated to recommend that a holder of Emerson or Emery exchange his shares for Eltra or Emhart at the end of 1970, unless the holder understood clearly the philosophy behind the recommendation. There was no reason to expect that in any short period of time, the low multiplier duo would outperform the high multipliers. The latter were well thought of in the market, and thus had a considerable degree of momentum behind them, which might continue for an indefinite period. The sound basis for preferring Eltra and Emhart to Emerson and Emery would be the client's considered conclusion that he preferred value-type investments to glamour-type investments. Thus, to a substantial extent, common stock investment policy must depend on the attitude of the individual investor. This approach is treated at greater length in our next chapter. Commentary on Chapter 13. In the Air Force, we have a rule. Check 6. A guy's flying along, looking in all directions and feeling very safe. Another guy flies up behind him at 6 o'clock. 12 o'clock is directly in front. And shoots. Most airplanes are shot down that way. Thinking that you're safe is very dangerous. Somewhere, there's a weakness you've got to find. You must always check 6 o'clock. U.S. Air Force General Donald Cutya. E-Business. As Graham did, let's compare and contrast 4 stocks, using their reported numbers as of December 31, 1999, a time that will enable us to view some of the most drastic extremes of valuation ever recorded in the stock market. Emerson Electric Company. Ticker symbol EMR, was founded in 1890 and is the only surviving member of Graham's original quartet. It makes a wide array of products, including power tools, air conditioning equipment, and electrical motors. EMC Corporation, ticker symbol EMC, dates back to 1979 and enables companies to automate the storage of electronic information over computer networks. Expeditors International of Washington, Incorporated, ticker symbol EXPD, founded in Seattle in 1979, helps shippers organize and track the movement of goods around the world. Exodus Communications, Incorporated, ticker symbol EXDS, hosts and manages websites for corporate customers, along with other internet services. It first sold shares to the public in March 1998. This table summarizes the price, performance, and valuation of these companies as of year-end 1999, and it can be found on the enhancement. Electric, not electrifying. The most expensive of Graham's four stocks, Emerson Electric, ended up as the cheapest in our updated group. With its base in old economy industries, Emerson looked boring in the late 1990s. In the internet age, who cared about Emerson's heavy-duty wet-dry vacuums? The company's shares went into suspended animation. In 1998 and 1999, Emerson's stock lagged the S&P 500 index by a cumulative 49.7 percentage points, a miserable underperformance. But that was Emerson the stock. What about Emerson the company? In 1999, Emerson sold $14.4 billion worth of goods and services, up nearly $1 billion from the year before. On those revenues, Emerson earned $1.3 billion in net income, or 6.9% more than in 1998. Over the previous 5 years, earnings per share had risen at a robust average rate of 8.3%. Emerson's dividend had more than doubled to $1.30 per share. Book value had gone from $6.69 to $14.27 per share. According to Valueline, throughout the 1990s, Emerson's net profit margin and return on capital, key measures of its efficiency as a business, had stayed robustly high, around 9% and 18% respectively. What's more, Emerson had increased its earnings for 42 years in a row, and had raised its dividend for 43 straight years, one of the longest runs of steady growth in American business. At year-end, Emerson's stock was priced at 17.7 times the company's net income per share. Like its power tools, Emerson was never flashy, but it was reliable, and showed no sign of overheating. Could EMC grow PDQ? EMC Corporation was one of the best-performing stocks of the 1990s, rising, or should we say, levitating, more than 81,000%. If you had invested $10,000 in EMC stock at the beginning of 1990, you would have ended 1999 with just over $8 million. EMC shares returned 157.1% in 1999 alone, more than Emerson's stock had gained in the 8 years from 1992 through 1999 combined. EMC had never paid a dividend, instead retaining all its earnings to provide funds for the continued growth of the company. At their December 31st price of $54.63, EMC shares were trading at 103 times the earnings the company would report for the full year, nearly 6 times the valuation level of Emerson's stock. What about EMC the business? Revenues grew 24% in 1999, rising to $6.7 billion. Its earnings per share soared to 92 cents from 61 cents the year before, a 51% increase. Over the 5 years ending in 1999, EMC's earnings had risen at a sizzling annual rate of 28.8%. And, with everyone expecting the tidal wave of internet commerce to keep rolling, the future looked even brighter. Throughout 1999, EMC's chief executive repeatedly predicted that revenues would hit $10 billion by 2001, up from $5.4 billion in 1998. That would require average annual growth of 23%, a monstrous rate of expansion for so big a company. But Wall Street's analysts and most investors were sure EMC could do it. After all, over the previous 5 years, EMC had more than doubled its revenues and better than tripled its net income. But from 1995 through 1999, according to Valueline, EMC's net profit margin slid from 19% to 17.4%, while its return on capital dropped from 26.8% to 21%. Although still highly profitable, EMC was already slipping. And in October 1999, EMC acquired Data General Corporation, which added roughly $1.1 billion to EMC's revenues that year. Simply by subtracting the extra revenues brought in from Data General, we can see that the volume of EMC's existing businesses grew from $5.4 billion in 1998 to just $5.6 billion in 1999, a rise of only 3.6%. In other words, EMC's true growth rate was almost nil, even in a year when the scare over the Y2K computer bug had led many companies to spend record amounts on new technology. A simple twist of freight. Unlike EMC, Expeditors International hadn't yet learned to levitate. Although the firm's shares had risen 30% annually in the 1990s, much of that big gain had come at the very end, as the stock raced to a 109.1% return in 1999. The year before, Expeditors shares had gone up just 9.5%, trailing the S&P 500 index by more than 19 percentage points. What about the business? Expeditors was growing expeditiously indeed. Since 1995, its revenues had risen at an average annual rate of 19.8%, nearly tripling over the period to finish 1999 at $1.4 billion. And earnings per share had grown by 25.8% annually, while dividends had risen at a 27% annual clip. Expeditors had no long-term debt, and its working capital had nearly doubled since 1995. According to Valueline, Expeditors' book value per share had increased 129%, and its return on capital had risen by more than one-third to 21%. By any standard, Expeditors was a superb business. But the little freight forwarding company, with its base in Seattle and much of its operations in Asia, was all but unknown on Wall Street. Only 32% of the shares were owned by institutional investors. In fact, Expeditors had only 8,500 shareholders. After doubling in 1999, the stock was priced at 39 times the net income Expeditors would earn for the year. No longer anywhere near cheap, but well below the vertiginous valuation of EMC. The Promised Land? By the end of 1999, Exodus Communications seemed to have taken its shareholders straight to the land of milk and honey. The stock soared 1,005.8% in 1999, enough to turn a $10,000 investment on January 1st into more than $110,000 by December 31st. Wall Street's leading internet stock analysts, including the hugely influential Henry Blodgett of Merrill Lynch, were predicting that the stock would rise another 25% to 125% over the coming year. And best of all, in the eyes of the online traders who gorged on Exodus's gains, was the fact that the stock had split 2-for-1 three times during 1999. In a 2-for-1 stock split, a company doubles the number of its shares and halves their price. So a shareholder ends up owning twice as many shares, each priced at half the former level. What's so great about that? Imagine that you handed me a dime, and I then gave you back two nickels and asked, "Don't you feel richer now?" You would probably conclude either that I was an idiot or that I had mistaken you for one. And yet, in 1999's frenzy over dot-com stocks, online traders acted exactly as if two nickels were more valuable than one dime. In fact, just the news that a stock would be splitting 2-for-1 could instantly drive its shares up 20% or more. Why? Because getting more shares makes people feel richer. Someone who bought 100 shares of Exodus in January watched them turn into 200 when the stock split in April. Then those 200 turned into 400 in August. Then the 400 became 800 in December. It was thrilling for these people to realize that they had gotten 700 more shares just for owning 100 in the first place. To them, that felt like found money, never mind that the price per share had been cut in half with each split. In December 1999, One elated Exodus shareholder, who went by the handle Gimme a Dollar, exulted on an online message board, "I'm gonna hold these shares until I'm 80, because after it splits hundreds of times over the next years, I'll be close to becoming CEO. What about Exodus the business? Graham wouldn't have touched it with a 10-foot pole and a hazmat suit. Exodus's revenues were exploding, growing from $52.7 million in 1998 to $242.7 million.